Hi and welcome to Caribbean. I'm here in lovely Barbados, sitting with writer Philip Nanton. Originally from St. Vincent, so he's a Vinci, but he's been dominant in Barbados for many years, and he lives here today. Philip's going to talk about his writing on the phenomenal jazz man from Vincent, Sheikh Keane, and his writing on Sheikh's work and his latest book, Riff, The Sheikh Keane Story. Philip, welcome to Caribbean.
Thanks, Yao. It's my pleasure. And it's great to have a chance to talk about the biography that I did on Sheikh, which came out in 2021. And it's published by Papillote Press. So to tell you a little bit about Sheikh, as you mentioned at the beginning, Sheikh was born in St. Vincent in 1927. He moved to, and he lived there till his 20s. He eventually, at the age of 25, he decided that he wanted to go to England to expand his opportunities. When he was going to England, he particularly thought he wanted to go and actually study literature. Although, even by that time, he had become a phenomenal musician in St. Vincent. He was playing with bands, even as a young age. There was a story that when he was playing with adults, sometimes he would turn up in his short pants to people's surprise and amazement. But he was so good from an early age, you know, people recognized his ability. And so he went to England thinking that because he was starting to write as well, and he was writing, and he'd written a couple of collections of poetry before he left. And he saw himself as actually a person who was going to study literature. But when he got to England, basically he needed to earn an income, and his trumpet playing, because he was a trumpet player at that time, you know, was the most lucrative opportunity. And he was never really short of work. And so he not only started to get work as a practicing musician, but he also got work with the BBC, working in the Caribbean service at that time as well. This was in the 1950s I'm talking about. So he started off, but he all went with the idea of getting into literature. Because the opportunities in music were there, and because he'd also started a family and he got married fairly early, he decided that he had to earn a living, and music was going to be it, because there was so much demand for his work. And working with the BBC, as he did, an opportunity arose for him to interview Joe Harriott, who was a Jamaican jazz musician who was established in England at that time. And Joe had his own band, the Joe Harriott Quintet. And at a certain point, Sheikh went to interview him about the band and about his music. And he got interested in it. One of the members of the band, a guy called Coleridge Good, who was a double bass player in the band, he decided when the opportunity arose, they were short of a player to match Joe Harriott. He recommended that Sheikh join the band. And that is how Sheikh joined the Joe Harriott Quintet. And at that time, Harriott was basically trying to improvise, find a new way to get into jazz, to play jazz. And eventually he came up with a version of what became known as freeform jazz. And the band started to practice freeform jazz. Now, freeform jazz was different from conventional jazz in the sense that conventional jazz works to certain chord structures and rhythms. But with freeform, what was happening is that Harriott would give like an outline of the music and set up a situation for the band. And then the idea was that each individual musician would be able to take the music in whichever direction they wanted. And that is very, very, very simply what freeform was like. Now, that was being practiced in the US. But the point is, I think that is important, is that it wasn't simply being copied by the black musicians in the UK. The musicians in the UK were also kind of coming up with it themselves. And Joe Harriet is credited with that basis. And the point about Shake is that Harriet needed somebody, if you like, to bounce off in terms of music. And Shake was his equal in terms of his ability to do that. So I wanted, Shake has actually, in the book, I have a quotation from Shake in which he describes freeform. And rather than me kind of talking around it, I thought I would just read a little section where he describes what is involved in freeform. And it goes like this. He said, "We usually have a rhythmic pulse or pattern going. I might be playing something soulful, and then Joe can get intense, so you have a conflict," in other words, a musical conflict. "Or he might join me, and you get a sympathy. The music draws its strength from this sympathy or contrast, and the vigor with which each man makes his contribution. The biggest freedom in our music is that the standard is an emotional one. When you are playing, you're listening, not to the chords as in conventional jazz, but to Pat or Phil or Cole or Joe." These are the members of the group. "And you have to know that man and how he's feeling on the particular night and that particular moment in the set to try and feel how he is likely to behave. The response or movement in the work between one musician and another might be sympathetic or rebellious. The important point, though, is that it relied on trust, and so they had to trust each other. And so, because they were all of a certain level of music, that it could operate like that." Okay, so that is that was a kind of music, and I mean, and they were simply innovative in terms of the introduction, the elements of jazz that they were introducing to the whole jazz scene in Britain and in Europe, because they were touring as well and playing at, you know, at festivals and all the rest of it. And eventually, the problem was that after a while, what happened was that the number of gigs started to decline, because at the same time, while jazz was sort of moving in these revolutionary ways, because essentially pop music was coming on stronger and stronger, I think that the pressure and the demand for the musicians to play was less because of that. And so, you know, eventually Shake played with other big bands. He joined bands in Europe. He tried to set up his own. He made a number of LPs on his own as well. His story is sad because what happened at a certain point, essentially he decided he wanted to go back to St. Vincent. And in going back, what happened was that he was invited back by a friend of his who was in politics, Sam Mitchell. And in going back to St. Vincent, he went back to head up. Sam Mitchell was in government at the time, and he invited him, Shake, to become director of culture for St. Vincent. Shake took up the opportunity, to do that. And in doing that, so he went back. He basically gave up his jazz career and his career in music in England to return to St. Vincent. This turned out to be a disaster, because after 2 years, the government changed. And the nature of Caribbean politics is that, you know, if one government brings you in, the next government is going to put you out. And that is exactly what happened to him. So here you had a brilliant musician, internationally known, suddenly ending with no gigs, no work. He'd lost his link with the whole jazz world in Europe, and suddenly having to find himself teaching secondary school, which is what he did before he left St. Vincent originally. But the other string to his bow was his writing. So he always wrote poetry, and he continued to write poetry. I met Shake in 79 because he had gone back in the early 70s to, as I say, to take up that job. When I met him, what happened was that basically I was in St. Vincent doing my own research. I was there doing my research, and
And the link that we had actually was through poetry rather than music, because, you know, we'd meet usually often in a rum shop in his school lunch hour, and we'd talk about writing, talk about the times we were both in England from the early days and so on. And he would comment on things I would show him, my writing, which for me was wonderful. But he was in a difficult spot, and it was not easy at all to survive in St. Vincent. This talent was simply going to waste. Eventually, he managed to get out, and he got an opportunity to go to New York, where for the last 16 years of his life he lived. And in going to New York, he still had contacts with the jazz world, so they would invite him back to play in London periodically when they revived the Joe Harriott Quintet. He had a good friend that he made from since his BBC days, a guy in Oslo, who started the Oslo Jazz Festival, and they would invite him every year to go and talk about his work, talk about jazz and so on. And these were like lifeline things for him, I think, where, you know, the international recognition had continued. And in fact, so much so that the very last gig he did was, he was invited to Oslo and he went. And when he got off the aeroplane, to cut a long story short, he got off an aeroplane. They had to put him in a wheelchair, and then he found himself in the hospital and he died a few weeks later. So in many ways, it's actually a very fairly conventional but fairly sad story of a jazz musician, because a lot of jazz musicians' life can be like that. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, it was important. It's important to recognize the phenomenal contribution that he made to both, to music and to literature as well. I haven't said very much about his poetry, but his poetry, because of his interest in jazz and freeform jazz, his poetry takes on these freeform elements. So what he would do is that basically, if you had a plain page, a conventional writer or poet would go from one line from left to right and then go down there from left to right and so on. Shake would take the page and he would kind of more like paint on it. So he'd put the words where he thought they should be on the page rather than in the conventional way. I mean, he could write conventional poems and that rhymed and so on. But, you know, he was much more interested in using the page creatively, if you like. And so you have a lot of people who, in the writing world will write in a jazz idiom, but here you had somebody who could both play jazz at a very high standard and also write poetry at a very high standard. When I say at a high standard, I mean by that one of his collections called One a Week with Water, won the Casa de las Americas prize, the Cuban prize for poetry in 1979. So you have a person then, physically, a man, a very large, big man with very, very strong character, who had this ability in both areas, both in music and in poetry, from a society like St. Vincent, which essentially is pretty casual about both things, about if you play a different kind of music or if you write in a creative way. You know, it's not going to earn you a living in a society like that. But here you had somebody of that stature coming out of a small society like that.
So I'm interested in finding out, and for the audience also, is Shake's work available, the music, the poetry, for public consumption? Where can you steer people to some source?
The music is much more available than the poetry, in the sense that a fair number of his tunes are on YouTube, and so people can just, if you Google in Shakin and put in YouTube, you will find his music, and there's some phenomenal stuff there, both in terms of a couple of films, short films of when he was playing with in. He was in Cologne for a while in the 70s, And he played with a band called the Kurt Edelhagen Jazz Orchestra. And there's some clips of him playing at the jazz concert with a large jazz band there. The last LP that he made and CD was called Shake Keen Reggae into Jazz. And it's on Linton Kwesi Johnson's label, LKJ. And you can certainly find elements from that on YouTube. So examples of his, and one of the pieces that I particularly like is a piece called October Woman, which can be found on YouTube. The person who wrote this piece was Michael Garrick, and he played with the Michael Garrick band as well. And, this piece for me is one of the best pieces that he did. The problem with the writing is that not many copies of his books came out. When the Casa Prize, for instance, in 79, what happened with that is that I think only 500 copies were produced, and it was never produced any, no more were produced after that. So his writing is actually more difficult to get access to than some of the music. I think the writing stands up against, you know, any of contemporary writers, because of the imaginative way in which he writes and his style and his relevance to the Caribbean. It's very, very Caribbean specific, even St. Vincent specific. You know, he's written about the volcanic eruption in 79 when we were both there. He has a feel for a small island society, which he writes about in a very creative way.
What intrigues me is that you said he was in New York for 16 years. And you talked about him doing gigs in Europe in Oslo and so on. Did he have any, was there any cross-fertilization? Was there anything happening in New York for those 16 years in jazz? Because that's a place that is a catchment area for some of the great jazz musicians. Did he interact? Was he influenced? Did he influence while he was in the United States and in New York in particular?
He was particularly close with a Vincentian musician called Frankie McIntosh. But the problem that Sheik had was that when he went to New York, he arrived and he didn't have a green card. So all the work had to be kind of under the table for a long time. And so what he would do is he would do arrangements, and there's evidence of various arrangements that he made for various Calypsonians who would go up to New York to record. And because he was, you know, so established, they would seek him out for that. occasionally he would play, but he couldn't establish himself until, you know, he actually was legit, as it were. And this was a problem. So a lot of the work had to be literally under the table so that he could get paid to eat. And it was depressing. It was a difficult time, you know. And also the other issue is that he and Frankie McIntosh actually wanted to get into jazz in the US. I think that's one reason why he went up there. But the problem was that, it was relatively late in his life. By then he was in his late 50s, 60s. He was, ailing. He wasn't very well. Another problem that happened in New York, which really upset him, was that he was, walking home at night. He lived in the Bedford Stuy area, and he got mugged, and he lost one of his teeth. And so, although he had dentures, he was never completely happy. What they call the embouchure that he had to be able to play.
Yes, yes.
And so that again, so that moved him more into doing arranging for musicians rather than playing. He did play. But most critics have recognized that, you know, he couldn't reach the high standards that he used to be able to reach so regularly when he was younger and before that those incidents happened.
But that's like an athlete having an injury. I mean,
exactly.
It curtails their career. I remember Arthur Boland, Trinidad and Tobago Olympian. he was unable to really recover from a car accident, particularly running the 200 meters because of the bend.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of put paid to his career. Mm-hmm. So I understand that. The other thing is, I don't know, I'm thinking, you know, I know, of course, Bed-Stuy was a notoriously dodgy section.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of this, there's a lot of tragedy here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess the balance, it's balanced with the joy of making music and writing and your creative combination of all your creative instincts and, mm-hmm. And you're compelled to do this and so on. So I may have balanced it out. Was there a silver lining to anything? I mean, I'm not just trying to be naive. And mm-hmm. how did he end his days? I mean,
well, nobody will, there's no evidence for what I'm going to say now, but this is just my feeling from the research that I've done. I'm not even sure if I can call it a silver lining, but, my sense is that he knew his days were numbered when he got that last call to go to Oslo. And my feeling is that he felt he wanted to go and die somewhere where he felt more comfortable than in New York. And I suspect he went went there, perhaps not necessarily consciously, but I suspect feeling that, you know, maybe the end is coming. And when he was in hospital, his friend, his good friend was a guy called Erik Bye. And Erik Bye was a man from Norway who worked in the BBC with Sheikh in the 50s. So they went back a long way. And Eric would constantly invite him, because Eric, he was an influential person in the jazz scene in Norway, would invite him to come and, you know, do all the regular festivals, the Oslo festivals. And he said, well, when I interviewed Eric before he died some years ago, you know, he said, Sheikh told him, you know, I said, when I die, throw my body in the sea. That was his attitude. And when Eric wanted to, the two of them to go and visit St. Vincent, because Eric wanted to see where Sheikh was from. And Sheikh had this fair strong antipathy to St. Vincent in a sense in the end, because he self-exiled himself from the society because of the experiences that he had. So Eric kept asking him, you know, when can we go and visit? And, you know, and Sheikh said, well, we can go to the Caribbean, but we can't go to St. Vincent.
Okay. Are there any younger people, emerging musicians, writers in St. Vincent in particular, and the Grenadines in particular, and Caribbean in general, that you think would have been privileged to see or hear or read his work and have been influenced by him?
Yeah, I mean, I would say for a start, I think Frankie McIntosh is a musician. They were very close, and I think he now works in New York and lives there and works as an established musician there. So he is a very, very much somebody who I would say continued the legacy in a sense. The thing about Sheikh's writing also that I didn't say is that actually it's very funny and he focuses on a lot of humor. And my writing, I've been influenced by that style. The first collection that I did, Island Voices, was very much influenced by his ear for Caribbean humor, if you like. And so I would feel that it certainly influenced me. The problem is that, and what I have tried to do over the years is bring his work to people's attention. So I've written, you know, I've done critiques on his work and I've written, both in the biography that I've done, a reasonable proportion of it is devoted to looking at the nature of his writing as well. So there is that. And in a sense, therefore, trying to make it more available. There are a couple of critics who have looked at his work, actually internationally. Veronica Austin is a woman who teaches at university in Canada, and she's done some PhD work on him. There's another person who, they're again looking at as an example of writing that is, if you like, jazz influenced, kind of. almost sort of poetry that is for the air as much as literally is for the page, which is what I think you could see his work as. So there are people who have started to take an interest. That's the point. And yes, and his work is, some of the work is available in St. Vincent, but it's a shame that the problem is that it's not so easily. Of course, it's in the university libraries and that sort of thing, but access is limited, to be honest, and that's a problem.
Yeah, because that dovetails with this cultural amnesia that has swept the region in the the generations that are emerging have little or no idea about a lot of their progenitors. I'm reminded of V.S. Naipaul, of course, Trinidad Indian writer, and his novel, Miguel Street. He had a short story on a writer called B.S. Wordsworth.
Yes.
And in the end, he says, I think the last line in that short story, it was as though B.S. Wordsworth never existed. And I think that's part of Naipaul's, and by extension, a lot of artists in the Caribbean, and beyond, are feeling that they would be like if a tree falls in the forest kind of scenario, and that there would be not legacy, not to be remembered, but at least to influence and to nourish and sustain future generations. So I think his case has been multiplied considerably across the region.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, but that's also what propelled me to work on his biography and make the work available. So the biography, what I've tried to do is apart from tell the story, providing the index examples of some of his poetry. I have a list of all the different, LPs that he's made and the bands that he's played with and that sort of thing. So I have at least tried to catalog this work, and so that it doesn't get completely lost. I think he is also an example of somebody who went. You know, that there is a very heavy push, for instance, now for people, you know, the sense of returning to the Caribbean. And his is an example that it's sometimes perhaps not always a happy ending in that situation.
Yeah, well, I would love to end on a positive note, but that might be a bit idealistic. But I sense that for the Caribbean to refresh itself into a new existence, there's a necessity for the generations to come to unearth a lot of this hidden culture and the majesty of it. And it will nourish them in terms of consolidating a sense of identity. Otherwise, it would just become a generic rubber stamp of some other ideology or civilization, you know? So I sense that there's kind of a little of groundswell of returning to sender, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's critical for survival, for cultural survival, for identity, for selfhood, you know? So this is wonderful to see this thing in print, eh? Because we're talking about a man disappearance, and I'm seeing a book on him.
Exactly.
And how many people have that legacy and that contribution available?
Well, he was a friend of mine, you know, and so I also wanted to recognize that. So I'm writing it not entirely as somebody who is distanced from him, you know, I wanted to pay a tribute, if you like, to some extent. But I also wanted to do it as fairly as I could. It was not just an emotional gushing to say how wonderful this man is. I mean, the man, you know, there were issues. He was married three times, and he lived quite a dramatic life in one way or another. So which I haven't really gone into here, but so his life was, you know, he had a friend before they left school. They used to have this thing, this statement that they would discuss. There's no up without a down, was what they would discuss. But I thought maybe what I might do is I might just end with one of his poems, which is both, I think, sums up his experience. He wrote this when he was back in St. Vincent. When he got back, he'd lost his job as director of culture.
But he wrote it in a Vincentian style, and it's called. He wrote a number of poems called Lessons, and this one was called Lesson 7, and the title of the poem is also called Credential. So I'll just read a bit of it. So this is how it, and it's a summary of his life basically. It goes like this: 6 year old, and my father gave me a trumpet, and he showed me how to blow it, how to polish it, how to respect it. And he say, exercise your potential, hold on to this. But the neighbor them say, boy, where your manners? Where your wool tie? Where your hymn book and your cork hat? You mean your father didn't give you that? So I try out my credential. I take it out and I polish it. And they like it. And I say, my father didn't give me that, but he gave me this. 18 year old, and my girlfriend vexed with me trumpet. She say, boy, where your money? Where your hot pants? Where your whiskey and your shirt, jack and your Fiat? That is essential, otherwise you're going to miss me, sweetheart. So I roll up my credential, weary polish it, then I blow it, and she like it. And I say, my father didn't give me that, but he gave me this. 25 year old, and I hit the mother country, and I show them all my manners and my certificates, but they trouble me. They say, boy, where your history, where your culture, where your father, where your money and your hot shirt and your felt hat? I say, no profit, no potential in this. So I take out my essential and I polish it. And I say, it's my father, well, give me that and well, give me this. 40 year old and I touch back down to my country and I like it and I cool it and I bring back all my father trumpet gave them. But the sweet fool them say, boy, what you come home for? Where your big car? Where your whole tie? Where your snap soul and your whiskey and your cantankerousness? Are we culture? Are we potential? Is definitely non-residential. All this trumpet is a famous load of piss. Hold on to this. So I heist up my credential. Same one with my father show. How fi polish? How fi respect? How fi blow? And I say to them, fear off.
Philip, thanks so much for bringing some light to this great man. And I just want to say, I'm going to look a lot more into the Shaking when I hear his work more. Listen a little bit here and there, but I need to get more in depth into this. So thanks for being in the Caribbean. And we got a 2-for-1 with you because we got St. Vincent and Barbados covered.
Okay.
But anyway, wonderful to be in Barbados. I wanted to spend some time with you. And thanks again for bringing some light to this man's life.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Yao. Good to have a chat with you.